We invite you to stay tuned as Meet a Pioneer is next.
KFAR, best sound on radio.
Good morning, friends, and welcome to KFAR Radio's Meet a Pioneer. Today is September 20th, 1985. I'm Gail Malloy. Every Friday morning at 9 o'clock, we spend an hour with the pioneers. This morning's guest is Annabeth Hanlon, and she's best known for her long and outstanding career as a teacher in the Fairbanks school system. This morning's presentation is sponsored by Don and Stasha Troutman of Two Rivers Lodge, the Binkley family of the Riverboat Discovery, Dr. Carol Davis of Denali Chiropractic Clinic, Jane McConkie of the Rose and Thistle, Larson's Jewelers, Mount McKinley Mutual Savings Bank, Last Frontier Realty, and the Rose and Thistle, Dorothy Rice's Rose and Thistle. And now Paul Rosenthal's Alaska Flag Song, Paul Rosenthal on the violin, Doris Stevenson on piano. Good morning to my guest in the studio, Mrs. Annabeth Hanlon.
Morning.
It's so nice to have you here. You know, we should mention, first of all, that it's 36 degrees outside. It's been snow flurrying all morning, even though it just stopped right now.
And I love it.
Yes. Isn't it? It's nice. You like the change in seasons.
Oh, yeah.
And this is harvest time. And we should mention that as a result of harvest time, I have a special gift you brought me from somebody.
Clyde Lawson, the man we call the Carrot King. Everybody loves him in town, and he grows these gorgeous carrots that are sweeter than anybody else's. And
they're the sweetest I've ever tasted.
Yeah, I was down there last night, and when I told him I was coming up here, he's very susceptible to beautiful ladies, so he sent you those.
Well, they're so good. You know, I can tell a fresh carrot that's tender, unlike any others, because you can eat it all the way down to the end and it's still delicate and tender and sweet down to the stem. Thank you, Clyde. Well, Annabeth, you have quite a teaching career in this town, and so many people in our audience right now have had you for a teacher, music and biology and different things.
Most of those sponsors I had. I was interested in that.
The sponsors of our program?
That you mentioned.
Really?
Yeah.
My goodness.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting, but I've interviewed people on this program that were actually students of yours. So many. Your story begins in the Indian Territory, now known as Oklahoma, in 1902, November 2nd, 1902.
Yeah.
That's right.
You're going to be...
More's the pity.
You're 82, almost nearly 83.
Oh, now, don't press it.
You look beautiful. I would never have guessed. We'll find out more. What's the secret to your...
Oh.
Well, tell me about the beginning in your family and where this all started.
Well, my father came from Canada, and he came down there to... he had graduated from Toronto University in law, and he came down there to help his brother herd cattle. And he was so entranced with the country, and he had such a pioneering spirit, that he read the territory law on horseback, and was soon admitted to the bar there. And at one time he was postmaster in one town, a judge in another town, and he wasn't yet a United States citizen. So he was trying a murder case over at Fort Smith, Arkansas, the center of the court at that time, and the opposing attorney got up and said, Mr. Rennie isn't even a citizen. So the judge asked him to approach the bench, and which he did. And the judge said to him, would you like to be an American citizen? And he said, best in the world, I certainly would. And he said, you are now an American citizen. And that's how he won his citizenship papers.
Oh, my goodness. That's interesting.
He was quite a pioneer. That's the reason he didn't object when I wanted to come up here.
Huh. Now, Rennie, that's your maiden name?
Rennie, yes. Uh-huh. It's Scotch.
Annabeth Elizabeth Rennie.
Yes.
And you came from a large family, lots of children.
Well, there were nine of us.
And you're right in the middle.
Yes.
I thought it was interesting that all of your sisters, including you, became teachers.
Yeah, oh, yes.
Now, you grew up and went through the school system in Oklahoma and then went to a women's college.
Well, they thought I was quite a tomboy, and they sent me over there to be a lady, but it didn't do any good. And I was determined to go, so I worked my way. I washed the dishes there at the dormitory for 7 years and enjoyed most every minute of it. I used to have some pretty good fights, but that's all right.
Now, you're a music teacher. You were a music teacher, but you also, as a student, were a musician. What did you play?
Oh, I played the bass fiddle in the orchestra there at college, and then I tried on the piano, but my bachelor's degree in music was in voice and public school music.
Did you always want to be a teacher because there had been so many teachers in your family, or did you ever
I think so. I think I did.
Now, what did you get your degrees in?
I got a degree in Bachelor of Music and one Bachelor of Science in Botany. And then I had a fellowship to Oklahoma University, and I had to get my master's in zoology. But I had been to Chicago University to study pre-med in all of the physical part of it, anatomy and physiology and that sort of thing, and Northwestern University also.
Now, how did you happen to, it was while you were teaching at the university that you came to Alaska. How did that come about?
Oh, that superintendent was coming from Philippines here, and he was recruiting teachers, and he came into my, I was giving a lecture in Zoo 1 at the university, and he came in there, and he wasn't interested because I was a science teacher, and I didn't know that, and we happened to have dinner at the same boarding house, and he told us all about the Philippines, and when he left, he said, well, if you know anybody who wants to go to Alaska and teach music, why, send them to me, and I said, well, I'd just as soon go to Alaska, and I'd just as soon teach music. So that's how I happened to arrive in Seattle about 2 weeks later after my mother and I had gone up in the attic and gotten out all the old wool clothes and all the, they had enough long johns in my trunk to, I think, to cover the army, and I never had on a pair of them until I began to dog race.
Oh, goodness. Now, that was 1927.
1927. I landed here the 6th of September, 1927.
So you were 25 years old. How long did you plan to stay?
1 year. Yeah, I just had a leave of absence from the University of Oklahoma.
The old story.
But at the end of that time, I didn't have enough money to get any place. So
Well, tell me about your arrival on September 6, 1927. That's this month.
You mean at the depot?
Well, just in Fairbanks. What happened that day? Well, what did it look like?
I came up on the boat. How'd Fairbanks look?
Yeah.
Well, I knew nothing. I was just like the tourists that come here now. I hadn't had time to learn anything about Alaska. I thought it was probably just a jumping off place and a bunch of ignorant people who were trying to get along, and I was going to lead them to the altar, I guess. And I hadn't been in town very long till I found out they were pretty sharp, PhDs on every corner almost. The cashier in the bank had a doctorate, and many of them had come up here. Some, I won't say many, had come because of asthma, and this was a good country for it, and it was never mentioned after they were here, of course. And you mean when I kind of entered the depot or came up? You know, when I got to Anchorage, I wrote back home that the pansies were large enough that you could put a silver dollar in the center and have an inch all the way around. And my father wrote back that he was so happy I had a dollar. And my mother was, she complimented the pansies. But anyway, I got to the depot here and knew no one except that superintendent, and you steered clear of him. And so I looked around, and I didn't know that every soul in town came to the depot to see the new teachers coming in, you know. So I got off, and I looked around, and I saw this thing that said Nordale Hotel. So I took my bag and went over and got in it. And everybody was looking at me, and I noticed some were laughing, but I didn't think anything about that. And across the bridge and up Cushman, up Second Avenue to the Nordale Hotel. And that thing was the hack for the luggage. So I laughed at other people later on, too. Well, I went into the hotel, and Tony Nordale was there, and I told him I didn't have any money, and he said nobody ever did have any money. So I signed the register, and got a room for $35 a month, and I knew that would be a big hunk out of $200, but that was the best I could do. And so I signed the register with a flourish and added USA on the end of it. And then I walked over into the lobby. It was full of people, mostly men. And some man walked up there and read it and said, "My land, she doesn't even know we're in the United States." And so I walked up to him and I said, "So what?" And that was all there was to that conversation. This is a short, fine-looking fellow, but kind of pudgy. And afterwards, Mr. Nordale told me that was the president of the university, Judge Bunnell. So I belittled myself already in his eyes.
Gosh, you arrived here with just no knowledge of the place, knowing no one. You had a lot to learn, and your education started immediately.
I was learning it mighty fast. Learned it mighty fast. Well, I didn't eat supper that night. And the next morning, I went over to the Model Cafe. That's where everybody ate. And Bernie Carr was at their cash register, and Lil Angerman was the, and there was Martin Penske, the baker, and Joe Rates, the cook. They were all partners. And we ordered, this woman from Texas and I ordered a bowl of blueberries, because that's all we'd heard about, blueberries and toast. We thought we could afford that. And so Lil brought them, and each one had a little stem on it like they do now, of course. And we just ugged at them. And then I said, "I'll fix it." So I asked her if she would bring us another bowl. So we dipped each one of these blueberries in our glass of water and took that little stem off. And by the time we had our bowl ready to eat, we were blue, clear to the wrist. And everybody in town had been by and taken a look at us. Bernie had called him and said, "Come over and see the new teachers." And so anyway, I learned you didn't have to do that.
Annabeth, how were teachers regarded in those days?
Teachers were on a pedestal when they arrived. of course, we were each oddity because I heard the youngsters in the hall one time say, "Now, in Oklahoma, where I come from," and I realized then that I talked differently than other people even, and I had never realized that. But we were on a pedestal, and our position was made, and all we had to do was keep it. A teacher was a teacher with a capital T.
We're visiting with Mrs. Annabeth Hanlon, my guest on Meet a Pioneer. We'll take a quick break and be right back.
Years ago, Mount McKinley Bank was founded by a group of forward-looking individuals who saw a need in the community. The new bank offered low-interest loans to encourage new home building in the Fairbanks area. It was an immediate success. Today, Mount McKinley Mutual Savings Bank is still located at 530 4th Avenue in the same building where founder Julian Rice and First President Judge Vernon Forbes served on the first board of trustees. The bank has seen a lot of history, and their solid background of investment and involvement in the community has earned Mount McKinley their own place in Fairbanks history. Mount McKinley Mutual Savings Bank is proud to sponsor Meet a Pioneer. At Mount McKinley, they're looking forward to a future as proud as their past.
Meet a Pioneer. KFAR Radio is proud of this show, and we're proud of our sponsors. Take it from Ag Baba, folks. One of the greatest pleasure trips you'll ever take is a trip up the Chena and Tanana Rivers aboard the riverboat Discovery. It's scenic, it's fun, it's a little adventure back into Alaska's past, a real riverboating adventure, guided and informed by lifetime pioneer Alaskans, the Binkley family. The Binkleys, three generations of riverboat captains on Alaskan waters, whose knowledge and love of Alaska is unsurpassed. Try the riverboat Discovery, and when your trip is complete, you'll feel like we do here at KFAR. It's a joy to speak of the riverboat Discovery, and it's a pleasure to do business with the Binkleys.
Sponsors of Meet a Pioneer enjoy the history and people of Fairbanks, like Dorothy Rice of the Rose and Thistle, a member of the community since 1956. The Rose and Thistle is many things, a florist shop with two experienced designers who do lovely fresh and silk arrangements. A wedding and formal shop with over 100 gowns in the shop, plus personal service and consultation. You'll find the Rose and Thistle at 330 Wendell Street, Monday through Saturday. Stay tuned for more Meet a Pioneer with Gail Malloy.
Welcome back to Meet a Pioneer with my guest, Mrs. Annabeth Hanlon. This is so much fun, interesting listening to these things. You remember those days clearly.
Oh, yeah, I just loved every one of them. Yeah. I was glad I didn't have money enough to go home.
There was something interesting called the teacher's delight. What was that?
Well, whenever, you know, I think I looked starved because when Bernie and Lil and the cooks would see that I wasn't eating much, why, they'd always give me something. And one of them was called the teacher's delight. And this was a great big piece of apple pie with floating in carnation milk with nutmeg and sugar on top. And that would really keep you in fat, I might as well say.
Do you like it still? Do you?
Oh, yes, if I could eat it.
You know, I think that when you grow up in Alaska in the early days when all there was canned milk, you'd never get over liking it. I've always liked it.
That's right. It just has a taste that nothing else has.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, it would really shock me because my mother wouldn't have a can in the house.
Well, what was it like when you started teaching? What did you do? And it was in the old main schoolhouse.
It was in the red schoolhouse that burned in 32.
Mm-hmm.
And it was great. Mr. Kramer, Edna Lawson's father, was the custodian, and they fired a coal burning furnace, and he was meticulous with the building, and he was very good to me. Whenever he'd know I wasn't there, well, he'd ring the bell and ring the bell and ring the bell till I got in. And sometimes if I were later than usual, why, he would just yank my coat off and hand me a bunch of books. And when I got up to the head of the stairway where Moore's office was, why, I had been to the book
room.
He covered for you, huh?
Yeah. Oh, he was a great guy. And but he's not the one that burned the building. He had to have a substitute at night. And this fellow stoked the thing and went downtown to, and we had lots of soft coal in those days, and he went downtown to play pan, and that's it smoldered. And Fred and Carl Parker are the young fellows who saw it. They were coming home at night, and they reported the fire, or I think the lot would have burned.
Gee.
Yeah. And
what year did that burn?
32.
Uh-huh. Now, that first year you were teaching, what did you teach, in fact?
I taught music appreciation throughout the school and throughout the grades. And then I had the Glee Club, and then I had a chorus. And some of those years, not many, but I'd have to at least start the orchestra and direct an orchestra until somebody would be employed. And they were fortunate when they could get Mr. Jacobs, a man who was in town. And Pop Wiener was a great drummer and a great bandmaster, and he helped out when he could.
Uh-huh.
And
the Glee Club was the girls' chorus.
Yes. I was the Glee Club, we called it the Glee Club. And then we had cantatas and operettas and so forth and so on. And we'd practice there in the big main hall. And then we would have them down at the Empress Theater. And Don Adler would play the organ for accompaniment.
Huh.
And I got one fellow down there one time that had a nice bass voice. He was supposedly an old Dutchman, and when we got down there, he could not get the pitch off the organ. So I just got exasperated, and I said, well, John Dunn, can you talk it through? And he said, yes. So he talked it through, and it was so perfect. It was wonderful.
Huh.
Yeah.
How did you teach music appreciation? What methods did you use?
Well, Mr. Ewell of the Presbyterian Church had given me a little organ, pump organ, that you could fold up like a suitcase and carry from room to room. And most rooms had a Victrola, they called it. And I had some records with me, and I would stand by the Victrola and play it, but I'd tell them the story, Peer Gynt Suite and all these things, and William Tell Overture, and they just loved it. Some of them went to sleep, but that was all right. You know, they're listening to music, and some needed sleep, so that was all right too. And then some days we sang. Most every day we sang a little bit, keeping pitch. And then I taught them some theory, those that were old enough, and so we just mixed it all up. And I told them the stories, and I played the music, and then I would, for their exam, I would play the music, and they would identify it with the composer.
Wow.
And it was stuff that stayed with them all their lives.
I was just thinking, I bet that absolutely has.
I've had all kinds of letters telling me that they would never have been able to recognize this, that, and the other if I had, and that their children don't know music.
Speaking of the children and students, can we kind of go back and picture some of those little kids and who were they and recall some things about them?
Little Eddie Stroker and little Sis Stroker and little Charlotte Ames. No, I didn't have her. She was a freshman when I came here. And
she was Charlotte Winner?
Charlotte Winner, uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
And Alaska Stewart, they were in high school, however. And I'm trying to think of some of the little ones I think of right now are not in town now, but the Erling children and the Fun children and little Harper children. John Harper lives here in town now. He's an adult. And, I don't know how many.
The Rust children?
Huh?
The Rust children?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
All of them I had. And there was Barry's down on the front street. And all the Hutchisons, and I had them, and then I had their children, and that was just great, because, you know, after you'd had them, and then their children came, you never had any discipline trouble, because the parents had already scared him to death.
Well, you had, like you say, generations. I mean, yes. The parents and their children.
Well, then after that, you know, one year they had, I think it was the first year after the fire, old DeVolt was the superintendent, and he had 52, and he was too many for one teacher, and not enough for two, so he gave them to me. And but that was a great year.
52 kids in one class.
Yeah, 52 years, two in the eighth grade.
Oh, my.
But they were prepared when they got to me. That's something that I didn't always have in high school. And so then I would have those youngsters. Well, then I had biology in the high school. So sometimes I would have the same children three times during their life.
So when some of those students came to you, they'd already had the word from Mom and Dad, watch it, you behave, this is Mrs. Hanlon.
Yeah, she'll kill you. Well, I never did really hurt anybody, maybe it was Steve Agbaba. And I couldn't keep him in tow because he just loved to put Limburger cheese on a hot radiator.
He did?
Oh, yes, he did.
No.
Well, that would go all through the building. Of course, we knew it was Steve. He kind of quit.
Limburger cheese on the radio.
Yeah, but when he was in high school, he was a good boy.
Can we tell a kind of a cute story about Alaska?
Well, which one?
Her little note.
Oh, well, I had this big study hall, and she'd look up at me and then look down, and she'd have her hand going. I knew she wasn't writing, and I'd wander around this study hall, and then I'd go back up and stand there and look, and then I'd go back, and you know, and years later, she was cleaning out some stuff, and she came to a note that she had written to her boyfriend, and so Edson Moody. So they had had one son later, and so Jimmy Moody was watching her, and she was throwing something away, and he said, "Well, what's this?" And oh, she told him, and so he took it. And Xeroxed it and sent me a copy of it. And it said, "Oh, no, I've got to quit writing now. There she comes." And I've forgotten all the things she called me in this note. But I've made her eat them since.
This is schoolgirl Alaska Link writing notes in class.
That's in study hall, I'll say, in study hall.
Study
she was
hall.
A good student.
Mm-hmm.
Very good student. And Mrs. Con Frank probably was one of the smartest girls I ever knew. And She was in that study hall. I never had her in class, but I had her brother in class, the one that's an eminent radiologist, and I believe he's something else too that's better than that. But he is semi-retired now, and he used to just sleep, and I'd have to say something wrong, and then he'd just rear up and tell the class that was wrong.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah. So I never worried about him. I knew he was getting it all. He always made 100 on his tests, and so I knew I wasn't giving him enough, or I would have kept him awake.
When you were doing your own studies at the university, you majored or got a degree in zoology. I understand you brought some of your own equipment here, microscopes and different things.
Oh, yeah. Well, I had a lot of music, and from 27 to 32, you can get quite a number of packages from your home. And I had them send me things to help me with my work. And but you know, after the fire, the school board replaced my material, my music, and also the whatever I had in the biology lab. And and also I know that they replaced the materials that the home economics teacher had, like her name was Laura Lee, and she married Bernie Carr and became Laura Carr, but she lives in Arizona now, a very fine person. We were all fine persons.
After the fire, school didn't stop, you just taught all over town, huh?
We taught all over town. I was teaching music, of course, and I taught first down at the Masonic Temple, then I went to the Moose Hall, And then on up, well, I'd stop at Mrs. Hunter's Inn and have a cup of coffee if Moore wasn't looking. And then I went to what is now that, I think it's the cancer clinic there on the 4th. Anyway, the American Legion Hall it was at that time. And then I had biology in Eagle Hall. And they had built some wooden partitions to make rooms, make classrooms of the dance hall at the Eagle Hall. And, that was fine. We were all kind of quiet. But once in a while, somebody would throw a grasshopper or a preserved frog over the partition, and Moore would, you know, he'd think I did it. Well, that was enough to fire me. he would like to have gotten rid of me because somebody called his attention to the fact that I was better qualified than he. Well, I wasn't. I never told anybody that I had this master's degree. I wasn't using it, so why brag about it? And it just happened that I was the only teacher on the faculty with a master's degree, and that gave them a little bit more, little boost to their credentials, you know, in the national. And I never got a dime for having a master's degree, and so I, but this friend said, taught here $200 for a month for 6 years, and he wouldn't ask for a raise because his wife didn't have a degree, and he couldn't have gotten a raise for anybody unless they had a degree, and he wouldn't get one for the rest of us if she couldn't have one. She taught the second grade.
Now, the reason you didn't go back, obviously, after that first year, you didn't save enough money to afford the trip back then, huh?
Oh, I didn't have any money.
So you continued to take leaves of absence from your teaching
University
position.
University of Oklahoma.
Uh-huh. Gee whiz.
And I went down to McKinley Park and worked for a month till Bob Sheldon fired me. And then that's the summer, that was 28, that's the summer Mary Louise Beeler and I walked a circle and back. And then we had gotten along so well that then we went to Valdez and back. That was a much rougher job, but we had a few rides down that way. Now, going to Circle, the weather was perfect, but in Valdez and way, clear up to Black Rapids Glacier, I think, sometimes it rained.
Now,
but we got rides with the road commission boys.
Now, wait a minute. You walked to Circle and back and then walked to Valdez. First of all, tell me about the Circle trip. You just hiked and camped out and carried sleeping bags? Or
No. We didn't have any sleeping bags. We just lay down and roll up in our coat and our jacket. Yeah, it was broad daylight, and the sun was still shining. There was nothing to... The only thing to be afraid of was a moose. A bear. And we could usually see them clear across the valley before they ever saw us.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
You just walked...
And I tell you, I saw more caribou than I ever thought the country had. And when they would migrate, it just looked like the whole hill was moving off, the crust of the whole hill. I couldn't see them because they covered the whole hill up there this side of 12 Mile Summit particularly.
Gee whiz.
Yeah. And moose every place, and we would see bear over on the other valley. We never had any. We had one close to us in the Valdez trip, but none in the Circle District.
And then you walked to Valdez and
back. Yeah, but I don't take too much credit for that because we didn't get rides going down. Everybody was coming this way, but and very, very few. I think we passed one car, but lots of trucks. And then we, but coming back, we had rides with road commission boys. Danny Johnson, Johnny Johnson was one. He was one time married to Danny.
Uh-huh.
Danny, well, what's her name? Waterrood. And there was her mother, Mary Brown. And her sister's Grace Petrovich. And, well, we stopped at Paxson's Lodge, the old lodge. And their father, old man Whitehead, was awfully good to us. And he let us stay around there a day or two. And, of course, we washed dishes and did whatever we could. And just had a good time till we had to start out. We had to get back here and didn't know whether we'd ever get back, and I'd get kind of groomed up so we could teach school that fall.
Gee whiz.
And Mary Lou just stayed the 2 years, but I stayed 3 years before I got enough money to go home on, and then I came back COD. I went into the bank and I told George Wesh, I said, I can get home, but I don't believe I'll have enough money to come back. And he said, well, we never have failed to cash your check. So I just overdrew, and it was quite all right. I can't remember whether that time I gave him a note or not, but one time I did this trick and went home, and when I came back, I owed him $1,800. Well, that was what I would get for the whole year, so I gave him, he says, I think you better give me a note, because I'd have to pay him a little at a time.
What was the relationship that you had with parents in town, the PTA and that sort of thing?
Oh, my. The PTA was our friend, and they didn't always agree, but we always ironed it out. We had some pretty good spats sometimes, but that just made a big PTA program or assembly, and everybody would come. And if we could get Mrs. Ringstad and Mrs. Rust on different sides, well, we just have a goodie. But they were always friends. They worked together and played together.
One of the mothers used to have you over for lunch, the teachers.
Oh, Mrs. Herring used to have all the teachers at Wednesday noon. And it was just a long block to her house, so we had plenty of time. And she always had something good that we couldn't cook at all. And I always thought, my land, the children were standing around there for their lunch, too, but she fed them at the same time. And but that was just terrific. That was one of the wonderful things of them. Mrs. Steger used to have me. Mrs. Miskovich used to have me. I used to eat all over town. If I didn't, I wouldn't have ever gotten home for a visit.
Gee whiz. That was really close-knit. And the teachers were very much a part of the families and
oh,
the
yes.
community.
I didn't have any, I never could afford galoshes that first year, and I was tripping along in my high-heeled shoes one morning real early. I always went to school early to get the lab all fixed up, and my feet flew out from under me right in front of the jail, and it was on the ground floor there by the federal building where it is now, and so that was a frame building. And dear old Pete Peterson and some of the inmates came out and took me in and laid me on a bench. And then when I came to, I was all right, and I stood up, and they poked me around and found out that I was okay. And I went out the door then just as everybody was going to work. If that wasn't something, I never could explain that because we had a jail custom then when they let the prisoners out and go to the picture show and come back and sleep there and let them go get out and give them some work to do. So there I was going and coming out. Well, I never could prove that I didn't sleep there all night.
When you came to Fairbanks, teachers were on a pedestal. Did anything ever happen that the community questioned or as far as your status as a teacher?
When they would get on us, you know?
Yeah.
Well, one time I was called down the hotel lobby parlor, and Mr. Noriel said there's a group of women there to see me. So I went down, and it was led by Ruth Barrack, who wanted to keep the town clean. and two or three others, and they visited a few minutes. Then I said, well, why are you here on Saturday morning? Well, we understand that you go into the Fairbanks Cigar Store. And I said, well, sure, I go in the Fairbanks Cigar Store. That's the only place in town that has ice cream. And I say, I go in there, and Jim Mulrooney sees me, and he takes my money and gives me my pint of ice cream, and out I go. And, they grinned, and somebody had heard me say that I always get my pint from the Fairbanks Cigar Store. So that was what got me into trouble.
Oh, my goodness.
My big mouth, you know, always.
But,
in my cantatas and so forth, I had Louise and Charlotte Wainer. They were the duet, and each had a lovely voice. Charlotte was contralto, and Louise was soprano. And then Alaska was a goodie. And, the Miskovich kids, I had six of them, I think, at one time in the chorus. And the boys and the girls both. And, I can't call names. I hate to mention anybody because of that. There was Chris Waddell, and there was the Rust girls, all the Rust girls, Lila and June and Cora, and many that have moved away, and all grown up. And I run around with them. I got to laughing the other day. They're my friends. They're my children. They were just children when I was here, but so was I. I didn't want anybody to know it, though.
Now, you married in 1945.
Yeah, I married Jim Hanlon. He was, I tried to avoid him, but I couldn't because he had red hair but brown eyes. And he came into the model and cafe, and he kept flirting with me. I was the cashier there at night during the war. Everybody had two jobs if they could if they could help out, and so he gave me a $20 bill for a $4 steak, and I counted him out 16 silver dollars because that's all we had. Was I never thought of anything else. That's all we had was silver. And he said, well, I don't want those. And so I said, well, I do. So I picked them up and turned around and put them in my purse. And to the last day I was there, Pete was still asking me if I ever gave that young man back his change. I said, why, no, I didn't give him back any change. He didn't want it. He said he didn't want it.
Oh, my.
And so I couldn't resist him. So after, they came in February, I think. I gave him a date in June. Yeah. And so anyway, he was just super, super, that man. And we had a wonderful life together. Yeah.
We're going to take our last break and be back with Mrs. Annabeth Hanlon on Meet a Pioneer. Meet a Pioneer is sponsored in part by the Forget-Me-Not Gift Shop. Sam and Jane McConkie believe beautiful things are timeless, and everything you find at the Forget-Me-Not shop is beautiful. Fine linen, silver, crystal, decorator items for your home or office, and that little something for special friends. Forget-Me-Not adds a feeling of luxury to even the most practical items. So, for beautiful things for years to come, for your friends, your home, or for yourself, remember the Forget-Me-Not Gift Shop, open 10 to 6, 6 days a week in Northgate Square. Meet a Pioneer is about Alaskan pioneers and the history of our last frontier. And Last Frontier Realty celebrates the past and its link to our future. You're invited to visit their office at the corner of Airport and Barnett, an original Fairbanks home completely restored, including archival photographs of the interior. On the Last Frontier Realty staff are some of the most effective salespeople in Fairbanks. They employ the most up-to-date marketing plans that work for you. And don't you enjoy their friendly messages on their sign outside? Please stop by and visit Last Frontier Realty, proud of our history and proud to sponsor Meet a Pioneer.
Alaskans have always been famous for their hospitality. the same wonderful hospitality you still find at the Two Rivers Lodge, where Don and Stasha Troutman offer the best menu and interior, a comfortable, quiet atmosphere, and that famous Alaskan welcome to the people who are today's history makers. If you've been meaning to try one of the most talked-about dining experiences in the Alaskan interior, don't wait any longer. Go out tonight to the Two Rivers Lodge, 16 Mile Chena Hot Springs Road.
When Roy Larson started Larson's Jewelers on that day back in 1946, he had big dreams of what he'd like his business to become. Over the years, some of those dreams changed and others came true. Today, Larson's is still a family-owned business and one of the finest and most complete jewelry stores in the interior. Almost 40 years of skill and experience go into everything they do. Like Fairbanks, they've grown, but they're still your friend and neighbor. Larson's, fine jewelers since 1946 at 405 Noble. Larson's offers 10% off all services and supplies to senior citizens. Alaska's spirit will never die. It lives on in second-generation Alaskans like Dr. Carol Davis of Denali Chiropractic Clinic.
Sponsoring Meet a Pioneer gives Carol an opportunity to show her pride in being an Alaskan and pride in being a member of the world's largest drugless healing profession. Becoming a chiropractor meant years of demanding study, a period of internship, and then meeting tough licensing standards. She's happy to talk about chiropractic with anyone interested in learning more about it. Just call 456-5252 or stop by and see Dr. Carol Davis at 1018 College Road on the east edge of Kramer's Field. Now back to our program, Meet a Pioneer.
This is so much fun talking with you. My guest is Annabeth Hanlon. You have a wonderful memory for detail and people and names and things. You married Mr. Hanlon, and you went outside for a while, but you came back to Alaska.
Came back in 56.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. When did you do the dog mushing that I've heard about?
In 42. I had the dogs earlier, but I was in the dog race in 42.
What race was that?
Well, it's a woman's race. It was only 14 miles, but and you know they used to let me out of school to make the run.
Really?
30 minutes they let me out, and I would make the run before dark, you see, this was during, I guess it was golden days, or no, it wasn't golden days. It wasn't in the snow. It was Ice carnival.
Uh-huh.
Ice carnival, yeah. And I had five dogs of my own, and I got two Indian dogs. And an Indian boy let me have two of his dogs, and I made the run.
Did you win?
Yeah, I won. I won the woman's race.
Is that? Uh-huh.
And that was in 1942.
Gosh.
Yeah, that was great fun, really great fun. And now, Steve Agbeb has all my pictures. I'm going to wring his neck if he doesn't find them pretty soon. And that was about all that was.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Now, you were the choir director at Presbyterian Church?
Oh, at Presbyterian Church. I directed that choir for 18 years. And we always had a Christmas cantata and an Easter cantata. And we were able to get, she was an artist, Mrs. Fund. Her husband was with the F.E. Company, and she played the flute, and so she assisted us. And Mrs. Rhineseth, her husband was a Standard Oil, and she was the accompanist. But the people like Hutchison and Grimen, Hutchison was my tenor, and he still has a beautiful voice. The summer before last, he sang at his grandson's wedding. He said that was his last, but he'll sing. He'll sing.
Mm.
And so many others. And then I had a young choir. I remember Alaska was in it. And one time I felt these seats just shaking and shaking, and I looked back, and she was on the second row, and she had a pin in the sole of her shoe and was acting like she was going to shove it up in the crack of the seat. Of course, she would never have done it, but she had that whole row thinking she was, and she had the first row squirming.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Yeah. But she did no harm.
It's so much fun to be learning all these things about your students.
About people. Oh, she's great. She is just a marvelous woman.
Huh.
Yeah.
Well, you're so highly thought of by so many people, and a lot of people appreciate you now, especially more now than then, because the things that they learned start to bear fruit
later on
in their lives.
Yeah.
What was your philosophy of teaching? What made you effective?
Well, I didn't have any time to waste. If they were there to learn, and when I first came here, all of them were there to learn. And so that's the way I want them to be. And when I told them something, I wanted it to stick. And I think I told them in that way. When I told them any discipline, that was one principal said to me, "Why is this crowd of boys always outside your door?" And he said, "They get in before the party bell, but why do they stand out there?" I said, "They're putting in their shirt tails and combing their hair." And he said, "Well, how do you do that?" I said, "I just tell them, don't cross that threshold looking like that. And I don't have any trouble." And they like it. They like it. I've had them. I did have one young fellow one time. He was a little timid. Frank Sams. He hung back, and he was an awfully nice fellow. And he said to me, "Would you really knock his head off?" And I said, "Well, don't tempt me." I never answered him. Of course I wouldn't, but he still thought I would.
Huh. Yeah. Could you teach again right now?
Well, they tell me I could not, and I think probably I would have more trouble with the parents, you know, because they'd say, "I don't want my child's personality crushed," you know, and all that sort of stuff. I think parents are a big drawback to the school system, and some will certainly not appreciate my saying that, but many of them, of course, are not. Many of them are, and it's sad that we have good ones with the bad ones.
Uh-huh. You expected a lot from your students.
I did, and I got it.
Uh-huh. That's interesting about the fellows having to have their shirt tails tucked in and look their best. And,
yeah. Well, I didn't want them in there like that.
Did you ever have problems you really couldn't deal with, or were you able to?
Oh, Billy Bob used to pinch the girls' butts, but when they were leaning over the microscope, but I didn't blame him much. But
Billy Bob, huh?
Yeah, he'll kill me. He'll kill me. I love him.
You are certainly a pioneer. How long have you? How does it feel? What's it mean? A pioneer.
I just have a idea of my own. I think that being a pioneer is much more than having been in Alaska for 30 years. Some people think a year is enough. A pioneer to me is one who's been fine when life seemed rotten, one whose ideals you have not forgotten, one who has given more than he has gotten. That's a true pioneer. There are too many that come up here with their hands out, and many go away with them full. And stay away, of course. But I think you have to be more than here 30 years. I think you have to love the country, and love the snow if it comes or if it stays. The only thing I don't ask anybody to love is that heat. I can't stand it in Oklahoma. Why should I try to stand it here? But this has really been great. I was scared to death all the time, and I have never wanted to do it. This is something that I kind of just save for myself and my friends, but it looks to me like now I'll have to come back next summer.
I hope that you'll come back on the program and tell us more stories.
We'll remember what we told, and we'll tell some more next summer.
This is a very special interview. My guest is Mrs. Anna Beth Hanlon, and thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you for asking me. Well, I really appreciate living in Alaska, and I appreciate so much this summer and last summer when you were all so good to me. The people up in Central were good to me. The people here in Fairbanks were good to me. People in the condo were good to me, and I love you.
You've been listening to Meet a Pioneer. A taped version of this interview will become a part of the permanent oral history collection of the Alaskan Polar Regions Department at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. This program was produced by Gail Malloy.
From ABC News, I'm Bob Walker. The mayor of Mexico City says at least 1,000 people are dead in the city's worst ever earthquake and that the death toll is likely to rise. ABC's John Bascom was in Mexico City earlier today.
I'm looking at a smoldering mass of rubble that covers about a half a city block. It used to be the Hotel St. Regis. The destruction here in Mexico City seems to be concentrated in the downtown area. In a 4 or 5 square block area, there were tall buildings completely crumpled to the ground. Others are missing a wall or the top few floors. But right next to the damage are 15-story office buildings completely untouched. Mexico City, it should be stressed, is not destroyed. In fact, vast portions of this city are intact. Flying in at night, you can see hundreds of thousands of twinkling streetlights, indications that many, many areas here are normal. John Bascom, ABC News, Mexico City.
In Washington, the U.S. Congress moved quickly to help the distressed people in Mexico. Here is Majority Leader Jim Wright of Texas.
In the old days, when a neighbor's barn burned down, other neighbors would gather around to supply help to rebuild the barn, to give a setting of eggs, to give a milk cow, to give a calf. This is what I think we have the responsibility to do for our closest neighbor in the world.
Earlier, President Reagan expressed his condolences to Mexican President Miguel de la Madrid and said American help would soon be on its way. This just in, a verdict in the cocaine trial of Curtis Strong in Pittsburgh, the jury finding Strong guilty on 11 counts of selling cocaine to baseball players. Strong was cleared on 3 other counts. I'll have more after this.
The stock is 30 and a quarter.
T-bills are unchanged.
When it comes to investing, knowledge is power. And that's where Dean Witter account executives can often give their clients a powerful edge. Because Dean Witter account executives are connected to one of the fastest communication systems in the business. It feeds them information almost instantly. Instantly. That's important. Because it's not only what you know.
They're going to raise their dividend.
It's how soon you know it. Dean Witter, a member of the Sears Financial Network.
Performance Report, Memphis, Tennessee. Wasn't long ago, Beale Street had fallen on hard times. Not today. Things have picked up, thanks in part to a new lighting system that spreads light evenly over wider areas. Phillips Petroleum developed Riton, the plastic that helps make these lights possible. And that struck a new chord with the people who work and play on Beale Street. That's performance from Phillips Petroleum. You'll find performance in everything we make.
The Senate Finance Committee, still looking for ways to cut the federal deficit, has voted to maintain the 16-cent a pack tax on cigarettes, and it took some doing to prevent that tax from being increased. Here's Democrat Wendell Ford of Kentucky.
Increasing the tax, or doubling it to 32 cents, only was defeated by 2 votes. To increase the tax to 20 cents was only defeated by 1 vote. And so we were very close to seeing the tax increased.
The Finance Committee also voted to impose taxes on chewing tobacco and snuff. The chairman of Wheeling Pittsburgh Steel said today he was resigning in an attempt to end a long 62-day strike by the company's workers. And one of Wheeling Pittsburgh's directors said he and several others had also resigned, saying the company is that close to going down the tube. The French defense minister has resigned in the scandal over charges French Secret Service agents sank a Greenpeace protest ship, and the premier has recommended the Secret Service chief be sacked. These developments coming 24 hours after President Mitterrand ordered a shakeup of the Secret Service Agency for which the defense minister was responsible. The first man jailed since the Vietnam War for refusing to register with the draft was freed today from federal prison in Lompoc, California. 24-year-old Benjamin Sassway was freed after serving 6 months of a 2.5-year sentence. This just then, the KGB in Moscow says it has arrested a Soviet who claims he was spying for the U.S. CIA and passing military secrets to an American diplomat. On Wall Street, the Dow Industrial's down more than 3.5 points at 1302. The volume now on the big board, 59,200,000 shares. This is ABC News.
I'm Merlin Olsen, and I know a great way you can send a gift and get one in return. Just call or visit your FTD florist and send a friend a pick-me-up bouquet. They'll get colorful flowers in a rainbow coffee mug, and you'll get a coupon which saves you up to $40 on a telephone from Michigan Bell Communications. Just choose one of the three phone models, mail in the coupon with your payment, and Michigan Bell Communications will send you the new phone wherever you live. So send a friend an FTD pick-me-up bouquet. It's a great way to send a gift and get one, too.
For the ABC Information Network, I'm Bob Walker.
This is KFAR Radio in Fairbanks, Alaska, and a good morning, everybody. We've got Heidi Rush, I understand, as we're going to zip over and have a quick coffee break with Nerlens this morning. Good morning, Heidi. How are you this morning?
Oh, I'm just fine.
Are you feeling good? It's Friday.
Pardon me?
Are you feeling good? It's Friday.
I always feel good, and Friday is an especially good day. You bet.
Especially good day.
Yeah.
What does Friday mean to you over there?
Friday means to me that it's the beginning of a real exciting weekend. Unfortunately, my Friday is usually Wednesday and Thursday, so Friday's the beginning of my week. And it's also the beginning of a good weekend. That's why I feel so good. I've had 2 days off, and I'm ready for a good one.
Well, tell me what's going to happen this weekend over at Scandinavian.
Well, we've got quite a few things on Friday.